morning, everyone. Welcome back. I feel like it's been ages.
Yes.
It has.
Yes. Time flies when you're having fun.
So I hope everybody has. There are two things going around. There's the orange sheet that we'll get to in a little bit, and then there's the background packet. That's the white packet. Unfortunately, the cover page didn't print, so we'll go without the cover page. But we're starting a new series this morning. You know, we're always looking for ways to inspire ourselves and grow. So here's the idea, and I guess everybody will vote with their feet. If it's a bomb, nobody will come next week, and then we'll know not to do this again. I find I have a lot of books on my bookshelf. I have many svarim, and I think the Torah in them is very beautiful, and it's amazing. But when you can better appreciate the person who wrote this particular work and the Torah that they're teaching, I think the impact that it can have is magnified in a very big way. So what I'd like to do for the next couple of weeks is a series that I'm thinking of calling, I think we could call it, Svarim V'Sofrim, Books and Authors. Because it's one thing to study books, and it's one thing to study authors, but it's another thing to study them in an integrated, holistic way. And that's what I'd like to try as an experiment. You know, the last few weeks we've been talking about Midos. I'm going to try this concept, and I want to begin with this set of Svarim, which I brought. That will be the focus of our learning this morning. This is a classic set of five volumes. See, little volumes. They're called Mayana Shel Torah, the Wellspring of Torah. I get a couple of nods. How come you're nodding, Sai? You have it. Many people have these Svarim. They're like a very classic, old-school bar mitzvah gift. I got these for my bar mitzvah. Now, unfortunately, you see, our first year in Skokie before we did some special work outside of our house, these Svarim were the victim of...
Usually, it's not quite so warm.
That's not why it's wet.
But I don't think there's...
Halavai. I don't think there's any mold. I dried it, but this was the special Skokie edition of the Mayana Shel Torah. That was pre-French drain. Now, Baruch Hashem, it's been very dry for the last 5 years. So this is a set of Svarim, which I had on my shelf. It's a very nice set of Svarim, and we'll look at it in a little while later, toward the end. It's a Likut, meaning it's a collection of ideas. There's not so much that's original in these works. And it says on the front, Ne'esfu, gathered, Nisderu, organized, V'ne'erchu, and edited, La'am, for the people, Al Yedei Alexander Zusha Friedman. Okay. And that's where it ended. But then, I happened upon a discovery to find out a little bit about exactly who was this Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman. And it transformed the way that I view these Svarim, the Torah in these Svarim, the personality of who he was, and the impact that it can have on a person when you approach this figure. So to do that, I want to start with the white packet that's in front of you. And I want to start with the white packet. You'll see on the cover, it says Diglenu. This is an actual page of the cover of a periodical that was published. If you look on the bottom, published in... You tell second to last line, it's a little bit obscured. Be, vav, vav, aleph, resh, shin, aleph. Varsha, meaning Warsaw. What year? Tuf, resh, pe, aleph, 1921. This was the first edition of this periodical called Diglenu, which literally means our flag. What is it? Kovetz Safruti Charedi Mukdash Le'inyane Hatsi'irim HaCharedim VeHistadrusam. It is a periodical devoted to articles that relate to religious youth. In his context, you're talking about in Poland, in Eastern Europe. And who is the editor of this work, which ran for years? This publication called Degleinu. You can get all 600 pages online at Hebrew Books. You could see it was this was put into Hebrew Books from a Chabad library. Chabad has a vast trove of amazing resources. Many of them were uploaded online. You can get the whole thing. It's all in Hebrew. But you can get the original pages. You're looking at the front page of the first edition on the bottom. Aruch Bidei Alexander Zusha Friedman. So here we are in 1921, published in Varsha. This huge undertaking of creating a periodical, a regular periodical for young people under the auspices of the Agura, of Yotzilorai de Aguras Tzire Emunas Emune Yisrael. So he is an editor, he is a publisher, he's a writer. He was born on the 11th of Av in 1897 in a town called Sochachov. Sochachov is an important town, a Hasidic wellspring of Torah. The Rosh Yeshiva, the great rabbinic genius from Sochachov, was known as the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer had a son who was known as the Shem Bishmul. These are great Hasidic masters living in this town. So here comes this young Zusha Friedman, who is raised, and he becomes very involved in education. So he publishes this work, and then a couple of years later, if you look on page 2, he publishes a small treatise with others. It's an amazing thing. I must tell you, what you can find today with tools, thanks to the web, it's astonishing. This is one page, it's about a 23-page manuscript. It is a guide to day schools. A guide to day schools. This was published in 1931. He's very involved in a broad network of day schools, and he's telling everyone this is what they came up with, him and a group of other educators, as the program for what students should be learning across the board in a uniform school system. And it's fascinating. It goes from Prozdor, you see on the top right in the little letters, Prozdor, that's Gil 4 and 5 year olds. So that would be, I guess, our equivalent of kindergarten, nursery. So what should they be doing? They should be doing Kriya Ivris, Hebrew language, Tfilah. Go down. What else should they be doing? Dinim, laws, Musar Umidos. Then going further down the list, what else should they be doing? Sipurei Kodesh Mitanach Umidrashim. What does he say? Shavuyos lehispatchusam, hispatchus, equal to their development. Meaning, the medrash that they should learn should be developmentally appropriate for 4 and 5 year olds. And then, veshashuim, what's shashuim?
Playtime.
That's what the kindergarten would look like according to the program of Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman and the others. And then he goes further. Mechina, Rishona, 6 and 7. That would be first grade. Shnia, 7th and 8th, 8-year-olds. Shlisha, all the way up to Shminis, 13 to 14-year-olds. And actually in Israel, they call the high school students Shministim, Shmini. So it's a fascinating description. And it's Sach HaKol. This is the amount of time you should be spending in your work week, in your learning week. So according to Rav Alexander Zusha, during the week, every child in preschool should have 27 hours of school with 6 hours of break scattered among the 27 hours. And the oldest kids, the 13 and 14-year-olds, should be having 56 hours of learning with 3 hours of break.
This is in Poland, right?
Yeah, this was in pre-war.
That doesn't include secular studies either.
These places, okay. These didn't have secular studies.
In the last line, the Mudechol.
Yeah, they had
12 hours out of 56.
Right, out of 56, they did have 12. But it wasn't like they were half and half. But you're right, there was... Right. So he's very involved not just in writing about education, but literally setting an educational program. But then things get even more interesting. So this work was published, this Mayona Shel Torah, was published during this time,
in the early 30s. And we'll see a little bit. It was originally published in Yiddish. We'll see that at the end of the packet. Right now, everything is totally fine. Then what happens in Warsaw in 1939? The war breaks out, and Rav Alexander Zusche finds himself in Warsaw in 1939, and he becomes extremely active in the life of Warsaw ghetto Jewry in multiple levels. This Rav Alexander Zusche Friedman. And what I'd like to share with you are several primary sources, some original documents that describe this man, Rav Alexander Zusche Friedman's involvement in ghetto life and Jewish life, specifically with a religious bent, because that's the context in which he lives. And it's really, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I want to begin with a kol kore on page one. That was Alfred, that was the introduction. On page one, it says on the top, "Hidden in Thunder, Esther Farbstein, Warsaw Ghetto, Purim, 1942. So there is an anonymous kol kore, an anonymous proclamation that was published in an underground newspaper in Yiddish. This is a translation. It was published in Yiddish in the ghetto in the spring of 1942. The name of the publication is called A Kol in der Midbar, meaning A Voice in the Desert, which was an Aguda underground newspaper. And we already mentioned, and we'll see a little more about it, that Rev. Alexander Zusche Friedman was very active in the Aguda, and he was very active in publishing. So there is a very well-known, very prominent religious Holocaust researcher, and her name is Esther Farbstein. Esther Farbstein wrote a two-volume work in Hebrew called Beseser Ram, which is translated to English called Hidden in Thunder, which is, I gave you the English version. She also wrote a couple of other important works on religious life in the Holocaust, rabbis and their lives in the Holocaust. So she found this document somewhere in the Yad Vashem archives. And she said, you know what, it hasn't been given a lot of attention. But it also doesn't say who wrote it. But she says, I think I know who wrote it. Who was running much of the Aguda organization and specifically the publications of the Aguda in the ghetto and before? It was Rabbi Alexander Zusche Friedman. And she compares it to several other writings and she says, this kol kore that we're going to see that was written in the ghetto in the spring of 1942 was also authored by this same Rabbi Alexander Zusche Friedman. And what does he write? And this is a very important document on two levels. It's written, as you see, in spring of 1942. This is before the great deportations of the ghetto. At this time, at the height of the ghetto, there are about 400,000 Jews living in the ghetto. The ghetto wasn't established until the fall of 1940. Germans took over in 1939. Jews were wearing armbands, but they weren't enclosed in the ghetto until the fall of 1940. Then things really got tense. Imagine the size of the ghetto was, I think, about 1.3 square miles. So that's like, imagine if you take like West Rogers Park. Oh, you could take Skokie. You think West Rogers Park is better because it's more, you know, urban. So you take from, I don't know, from Pratt to Howard and a couple of blocks wide, and you had 400,000 Jews. You were averaging about 7 people per room and 20-some people per house in the ghetto. So this was before, and then in the summer of 1942, that's when the massive deportations start from the ghetto. Then in the winter going into 1943, the Germans make plans to liquidate the ghetto. The ghetto uprising begins in Erev Pesach, 1943. By that time, they're going hand-to-hand, destroying the ghetto one block by block. Some of the remaining Jews were still working in a shop, many famous personalities are working in a shop called the Schultz Shoe Factory, and then we're going to come back to the Schultz Shoe Factory because Rav Alexander Zusche was there, and then they were taking many of the workers in the Schultz Shoe Factory, the leather factory, were taken to a work camp called Travniki, not far from Lublin. Okay? That's kind of like the background of this. What did they know? What did they think in the ghetto? What did they know? that they know when the people were being deported. Now, this is before the massive deportations, but still people, many tens of thousands had already been deported. What did they know? And what did they? How did they respond? So this document is incredibly telling. Says the document, it's about Mechias Amalek, wiping out Amalek. So he begins, presumably Rabbi Alexander Zusha begins, and if even it wasn't his hand, he's certainly intensely involved in this document. Zachor is Asher Asalacha Amalek. Milchamol LaHashem ba'Amalek midor dor. Zachor, and then what does he say? Machol Simche Ezecher Amalek, and Lo Tishkach. Many nations have waged war against the Jews, done evil to them. But Amalek is something else entirely. Amalek made annihilation of the Jews its goal, its program, its principle, deliberately, in cold blood, sadistically, according to a plan, and in an orderly manner, through laws and clauses, and the decree was issued in Shushan. Amalek and his descendant Haman are not satisfied with just murdering individual Jews, putting to death a few individuals. No, that's too little, a trivial matter, a real disgrace. They want to destroy the entire nation all at once, rip out the roots, eradicate Judaism, destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, the nation of Mordechai. So this is very telling right away, right? Because now we understand that the Jews who were living in the ghetto did grasp what was going on. They understood what was happening. So it's number one, it's a traditional homiletic concept. It's a homiletic device that he's using the drush, the model of Haman, and then before that, Amalek, and it's time before Purim. But what he's telling you is he understands what the Germans are up to. Because before that, it's hard to know, because the Germans were experts in deception. Some of us are familiar. When people were sent on trains, they were told, write postcards and, you know, don't worry, we're going to reset. It was called resettlement to the east. We want to send things back to your family. All kinds of other deception devices. But we see that already in the spring of 1942, the Jews of the Warsaw ghetto knew what was going on outside. And they knew what the plan was. Now he goes on, he says, Amalek is concerned not so much with the Jews as with Judaism. The Jewish outlook, the Jewish worldview, the Jewish sense of honesty, the Jewish sense of justice, the Jewish attitude toward the indignant and the deprived, the Jewish aversion to bloodshed and violence, the Jewish interpretation of the concept of heroism. All of these are diametrically opposed to Amalekism, and they infuriate Amalek. Because he quotes from the Megillah, V'daseihem shonos, Mikolam, their laws are different than everybody else. So here too, you have an important observation on two levels. One is, there is a beautiful essay from Rav Shagar, Zichrono Levracha, Rav Shimon Gershom Rosenberg, who, he develops the notion based on Nietzsche. I don't know anything about philosophy, but there was a German philosopher, Nietzsche, who develops a concept called the will to power, and it's about the strong essentially overcoming the weak, and that is the telos of humanity. It's also not coincidental. There's something called the T4 program. The T4 program was the first group of human beings who were euthanized by the Germans were the disabled. So the notion of, you look at the way that a Jewish community would look at people with disabilities, and the way that a Nazi community would look, a Nazi regime would look at people with disabilities, it's one example of where you can kind of see that tension. Is it about the strong devouring the weak? Or is it about creating a community of Tzelem Elokim and of all human beings and everybody trying to be together and, you know, sharing? So that's an example where he says it's not just about killing Jews, it's about eradicating Judaism. So now he goes on. On the next page, that we are a divine concept. And now go to the third paragraph. And this is where the homily begins. And he wasn't formally a rabbi, certainly wasn't a preacher. In source paragraph 2 is they're not comfortable with a faith in such a God who sees everything and demands accounting for wrongdoing. That's similar to the ethical demands of Judaism and against the will to power. Amalek always weakens when weaknesses are discovered among the Jews. If they become lax with respect to Torah, if they are somewhat divided and fragmented, when their faith loses some of its intensity, if they long to form too much of a constant connection with the non-Jewish world, when they want to lick the bones from Ahasuerus's tables and dance at his balls, then Amalek comes, sword in hand, and Haman arrives with his edicts. Amalek is the whip, the strap for the rebellions that divine providence instituted to remind the Jews that they are Jews and they must be Jews. Amalek is the rod from time to time that is given dominion over the bodies of the Jews when there is a need to call upon them to repent. God sets upon them a king as harsh as Haman. Consequently, it's very, very strong. Consequently, I want to do one more page before an editorial comment on this. We must always remember what Amalek did to us and what it is doing. When Amalek is given dominion over the Jews and wants to destroy them, we have to remember not only the evil, but also the reasons that prompted its empowerment and growth. We must remember not only the Amalek on the outside, but the Amalekism that has penetrated our insides, and we must make an effort to efface and uproot the Amalekism from inside us. Then the external Amalek will automatically be wiped out. If Amalek comes because they became lax with respect to the Torah, which is a paraphrase from the Gemara, then we have to intensify and expand Torah study. If Amalek's power stems from doubts and carping, is God among us or not, then we have to greatly strengthen our faith and trust in God. If Amalek draws its strength from our coldness, Asher Karcha, and from our negligence and helplessness, the stragglers in your rear, then we must be fervent, strong, and valiant, bear everything, suffer as Jews, and withstand all the trials. So if someone were to say this today, or to write this today, so then you wouldn't tolerate it. But imagine the people, and when I shared this with someone, with one of the docents at the Holocaust Museum, the question was, where did the Jews have that strength? And we don't know. It's superhuman strength. Because by 1942, it wasn't 1940. It wasn't 1941. It was 1942. At this point, there's a footnote. The footnote was probably written a little bit later in the works of the Eish Kodesh, of the Holy Pius Setzner Rebbe, who will be, by the way, together in the Schultz factory with Rebbe Zusha Friedman. We'll get to that. He writes in one of his drushes about Hanukkah earlier in the war, he writes how we have never seen any suffering like this since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Then the bottom of the Eish Kodesh, in the bottom of the manuscript, there's a footnote. And it says, now, what we have seen, it exceeds even that anything Jews have ever known in their history. The suffering that we have seen in the Warsaw Ghetto and that which is happening to the Jews. And it's interesting to note that in the writings, this you'll find in Nehemiah Poland's book called The Holy Fire, in the writings of the Pius Setzner, moves away from the idea of schar va'onesh, punishment and reward, in his theology, in his drushos, in his sermons, in his homilies. That's gone by 1942. He's not talking about, you know, what we did wrong and why this is happening. He's talking about Rabbi Akiva and martyrdom and divine suffering and a lot of other themes, but he's not talking about this. And yet you see, there were still people who were so strong in their faith that this is how they responded. And this is the other half, I think, that's significant about this letter, which is, it wasn't just about physical resistance. It was also about spiritual resistance. What's the letter calling for? It's not calling for armed resistance. That's a separate discussion. There were rabbis who were involved in armed resistance. One of them was the great Gaon and the Tzaddik, the martyred Rabbi Nachum Zemba. We don't have time to talk about him today. But he's calling on religious resistance, meaning that they can't take away from us. I mean, they'll take away everything that they can. But it almost goes back to the man's search for meaning concept, you know, where no one can take away who you are and how you relate to things. So the resistance that he's calling for is a spiritual resistance. This is in the ghetto. This is how strong, how firm Rav Alexander Zusha was in his devotion, his dedication to his cause, and this is what he's sharing with others. Now, there were several people who knew him and who wrote about him. There was a ghetto chronicler. I forgot the book at home. I should have brought it. His name was Dr. Hillel Seidman. He was a great scholar and academic. He was a deeply religious man who was highly regarded throughout Europe, including in this volume, which I'll tell you about. There was a letter there addressed to him from the Chafetz Chaim himself, asking for his assistance in a certain matter. And then the Chafetz Chaim writes him back a second letter, a thank you letter for his help. Dr. Seidman was writing a Holocaust chronicle, a diary, in the ghetto. And he had access through his librarians and all this kind of stuff. He had access to certain people who were outside the ghetto and some hiding places inside the ghetto. So, long story short, which you can take a look and read, I'll tell you in a second, he takes pieces of this diary and buries them and hides them in different places. Some of them are with non-Jews outside the ghetto, some of them are in the ghetto. He gets sent to a work camp, ends up in France, survives the war, goes back, spends a great deal of time and personal risk, and is able to retrieve the bulk of the entries from the ghetto and put it together. It was published in Yiddish, in the 1950s, maybe it was in Hebrew, and then it was translated, published by Feldheim, called the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries in 1997. It's an amazing, amazing book. Phenomenal, incredible. The thing is, though, the problem is that you can only get it now for like $240 used on Amazon. It's out of print. But Spertus has a copy. So last week, I went down to Spertus, and they loaned me their copy of the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, and it's amazing. So first, the first section of the book is his diary, the pieces that he puts together. The last section of the book is another section. It's called, I'll go to page 5 in a second, not yet. It's called, you'll get to in a minute, it's called Personalities I Knew in the Ghetto. And he describes a couple of people, major figures, who he remembers and what their experience was like in the ghetto. And one of them was this Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman. Okay, so what happens to Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman? So if you look on page 4, before we get to the description of him, you have here an entry. I guess this is what we would call the closest thing to a death certificate, so to speak, for Rabbi Alexander Zusha Friedman, and this is from Yad Vashem. This is accessible to anybody. You can access the Yad Vashem archives of martyrs from the Shoah from your own computer if you have relatives or people you know you want to research. So this is a Xerox copy of an entry from the Yad Vashem archives. You'll see the date on the bottom, way down at the bottom, 11-7-55. Who wrote it? Chana Friedman Hoffman. Chana Friedman Hoffman. Who is she writing about?
Her father.
Close. Not her father?
Her husband.
Nope. Keep looking.
Her brother.
What's her relation? You see where it says? Krova.
Oh.
Right? Her uncle. Her uncle, her father's brother, was Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman. So go to the top. Shem Mishpacha Friedman. Name, Alexander. Shem Kinui. Nickname was Zisha. Father's name, Yehoshua. Mother's name, Sarah. Family situation, married, one daughter. What was her name? Rachel. Born, 1898. We think it was 1897, somewhere around there. Where was he born? Polonia, Sochaczew. He was born in Sochaczew. Where was he? Hishtayech lekilat Sochaczew. Baaretz, Poland. Where was he? Bishnas, 1939. Where was he? In Poland. Hamiktsoa. Pekid Ba'agudas Yisrael Be Varsha. Okay, so he was working for the Aguda in Warsaw in 1939. Where did he die? Hamakom Vahasman Shel Moso. Travniki, 1943. So that's the end of the story. Rabbi Alexander Zisha was working in the Schultz factory in 1943 until he was transferred with the Holy Pius Etzner Rebbe and other distinguished personalities to the Travniki work camp outside of Lublin until the fall of 1943. What happens then? The Germans decide to liquidate the work camp. So they take all the Jews out of the Travniki work camp and they kill them all. They shoot them to death. And that's where he dies, and that's what his niece is describing. His wife's name was Chaya Pesa, and his daughter's name was Rachel. She was 15 to 16 years old. In 1941, 1942, she was deported. That's why it says, Lo Yadua. We don't know with certainty when or how she died, his daughter. So that's the biographical end of the story. But it gets filled out in this amazing way on page 5. Here's his picture. Hillel Simon also wrote an entry on Rav Alexander Zusha Friedman in an encyclopedia of martyred Rabbanim from the Holocaust. 7 full volumes just of little biographies of rabbis who were killed in the Holocaust. He was the Secretary General of the Polish Aguda, and he describes his activities. On the right-hand side, he describes how Rav Alexander Zusha was born in Sochachov in 1897, even though his niece said he was born in 1898. Zisha's bar mitzvah drasha, last paragraph on page 5, was a sensation in Sochachov, with townspeople crowding in at the doors and windows to hear the young prodigy amaze the learned guests with his knowledge and ingenuity. Okay, next page. He married a girl from a small village nearby, and he joined the Agudah at a young age. He became a speaker. Next, you see in the following paragraph, the last paragraph on the left of page 6, third line. In his capacity as editor of Diglenu, that was the magazine that we started with. On the left-hand side of page 6, fifth line down, Reb Zisha attracted many adherents with his polished prose and his innovative thinking. Long after he relinquished his post, he was warmly regarded as the father figure of Tzeiri Aguda, of the young people of the Aguda. His speech at the first National Aguda Convention in 1919 enraptured the audience, and he was chosen as secretary of Aguda's central organization, then operating under the name of Shlomei Emune Yisrael. Then, page 6, on the right side, he joins the Warsaw Kehila Council, and he was very active. Page 7, keep going. He's writing in Diglenu, as well as writing together with Rav Nachum Zemba. Bottom of the right-hand side on page 7. On November 20th, 1939, Rav Zisha was held hostage by the Nazis, together with 21 other communal activists, to present resistance while establishing a ghetto. In fact, the ghetto decree was then postponed until, like we said, in the fall of 1940. During the war years, I'm on page 8, Reb Zisha rose to the challenge of the hour and played a leading role in the ghetto. Soon after the invention, he established, together with Reb Itcha Meir Levin, a large soup kitchen in the Beis Yaakov Hall and 37 Nalwiki Street, run by the Beis Yaakov teacher. More soup kitchens were set up, and they were helping the poor people in the Malamdim. Later, next, Reb Zisha utilized the joint to set up an elaborate network of religious education, officially masquerading as soup kitchens and kindergartens, etc. Next column, fascinating. Adam Chernikov was the president of the Judenrat, the Jewish Council of Warsaw. He frequently invited Reb Zisha Friedman to become a Judenrat member, but he had refused. In February of 42, Chernikov confessed to Reb Zisha that he had decided there was no point in Jewish survival in the ghetto unless it had some Jewish background in faith. He asked him to infuse religious input and promised his support. So Reb Zisha readily agreed to establish the Judenrat's religious committee. And he names the various people. And what did they do? They changed the official compulsory work day from Sunday to Saturday in the ghetto. Shabbos. Next page. He describes his life in the Schultz factory. In the factory, in the bottom left, worked many Rabbonim, Hasidic Rebbes, and scholars also, quote-unquote, worked. He met the brother of Rav Moshe Bitzalo, the brother of the Ger Rebbe, the Rav of Sosnowich, the Rav Klonimus Kalman, etc. By that time, on the right-hand column, page 9, Reb Zisha was the sole survivor of his family. His parents-in-law, his wife and only daughter, born after 18 years of marriage, had all been deported. His 13-year-old daughter was very intelligent, and Reb Zisha showed me a poem of eulogy that he had written on his only child. In it he wrote that he did not know what to pray for. An early homecoming or an easy death without suffering. I tried to persuade him to leave the workshop and come to the Judenrat archives, but he felt safer at the workshops. And then he describes how he was in contact with him until 1943, until he was in Travniki. But he was not the only one. There was a man, a Rav, I should have brought his picture. I don't think they have the picture in this volume. His name is Rav Shimon Huberband. Shimon Huberband was also a great scholar, an archivist, a librarian, and a religious man. He was a member of Emanuel Ringelblum's Onik Shabbos archives. He worked for the Onik Shabbos, and when he was killed in 1942, one of the members of the Onik Shabbos archives eulogized him, Rav Shimon Huberband, this young religious scholar. He also kept a chronicle, which survived him. He was killed in 1942, but this did survive the war as part of the archives that were put away. There were quite a few documents that were hidden and that were saved. So in this document, it was translated into English, called Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust, Shimon Huberband, Hashem Yikom Damo. So he chronicles aspects of life in the ghetto specifically related to religious life. And in it, he refers to lots of different figures if you go through the book and use the index. And in it, he describes one episode with Rav Alexander Zisha Friedman. So this man was not just, Rav Zisha Friedman was not just a teacher. He wasn't just a publisher. He wasn't just a malamid. He was a leader in the ghetto. And this is the story. It starts on page 11. I gave you the whole selection here from Kiddush Hashem. This is not secondhand Maisalach. This is original testimony in the ghetto, written contemporaneous. In early 1942, I'm on the bottom of page 11 on the right-hand column. A special tribunal sentenced approximately 300 Jews to death for the crime of crossing the ghetto border. All the convicts were held in the Jewish prison at 24 Gessia Street. I apologize for butchering all the Polish names as we go along. During the first days of January 1942, the chairman of the Judenrat, Chernikov, called a meeting in which he announced that the sum of 1.5 million zlotys, these are from the Jews in the ghetto in 1942, with which the Germans could purchase 1,500 sheepskin furs, the doomed Jews would be released. So then they had several meetings. A huge public assembly took place. And who was there? Third paragraph. At the head of the table were seated Dr. Ringelblum, Director Guterman, Manoach Kahn, Rabbi Nogashinsky, Starbinsky, I don't know who some of these people are, many of these people, Z. Friedman. Who is Z. Friedman? Rabbi Alexander Zisha Friedman. The following people spoke on behalf of the collection campaign. Dr. Ringelblum, Z. Friedman, Rabbi Nogashinsky, Councilman Rosenman, Dr. Hector Guterman. What did he say? Shimon Huberband wrote down the meeting's minutes. So look on the next page. Secretary, by the way, on the top of the next page, you see on the top of page 12, Secretary Rabbi Huberband. He was the official secretary. Next page, page 13. Mr. Z. Friedman. Rabbi Alexander Zusha was not even referred to as a rabbi. He was Mr. Think about this person. Think about how the picture is coming together. And this is what he talks. This is what he said. We are accustomed to referring to every event in Jewish history, in the Jewish community during the war, as a historical event. But this campaign is truly an historical one. It involves rescuing the lives of over 300 of our brothers and sisters from certain death. If the Kehillah had proclaimed this fundraising campaign only among the wealthy Jews, we, the masses, would have had to protest their failure to give us a part to play in this mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim, liberating captives. Now that we've been called upon to participate in the campaign, we must do so. According to Jewish law, one does not secure the release of captives for more than their wealth, but this principle only applies when the captives are not in life-threatening danger. We read in the Bible concerning the plagues of darkness, and they did not see their brethren, i.e., one brother did not help another the other. If, on the other hand, we help our unfortunate brothers, then we will be blessed according to the verse, and for all the children of Israel there was light in all their dwelling places. Classic, traditional rabbinic fundraising speech. Right? The rabbi could say this from any pulpit at any time. And think about when it's being said and where it's being said. Unbelievable. And we have one more document. This is from the Yad Vashem archives. Later in 1942. Erev Tisha B'Av. What's happening in the summer of 1942? The great deportations have begun. So this was a different archivist, a different diary. His name is Yitzchak Zuckerman. On Wednesday, July 22nd, 1942, on Erev Tisha B'Av, the liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto was begun. The public committee was immediately summoned to find out what the situation was and to take measures. So who was there? L. Bloch, Shmuel Breslov, Dr. A. Berman, Yitzchak Zuckerman, Zisha Friedman. And here further, they have more discussions of what to do, how to deal even at this late era. So what did they have, though? Look at the last paragraph, last line. The fighting organization had been set up, but all the weapons there were in the ghetto at that time consisted of just one pistol. Oyin v'nor. So now we put all of this together, and we come back to our little kleiner bar mitzvah gift, the Mayona Shel Torah. So here on the next page is the Sharblat of the original edition of the Mayona Shel Torah, Der Torah Kvel. It's originally in Yiddish. Werter, like small Wortloch, ideas, Rayonos, Hashkafas, von Geoinu Gedol Yisrael, of the Wochen Parshios, Haftoros, Yomim Tovin, und Tariag Mitzvahs, of the week's Parshios, the Haftoros, and then, and next in Yiddish, Geklibin, zu Mengish, Delta, etc. My Yiddish is not that good, let's be honest. Published in Varsha, Tov Reish, Tzadi Ches. When was the first edition published? Tov Reish Tzadi Ches. That means 1938. Just before the war breaks out, he publishes this thin volume, Mayona Shel Torah. And I keep coming back to my little bar mitzvah gift. You look on the front, it says, collected by no rabbi, just Alexander Zusha Friedman. That's all it was. And what's the purpose of this? So I gave you in the Hebrew edition, he has a hakdama, he has an introduction. He says, look, me'oz u'me'olam, if we had another hour, which we really need, I would go through the whole introduction piece by piece. He says, from time immemorial, the Torah was always, he tells us, the source of consolation, strength, and guidance. The problem is, he says in the next paragraph, in the last tekufa, through a kind of a weakening of our spiritual composition, where we're not as strong as we used to be religiously. He's writing in 1938 in Warsaw. He says, look, the problem is that we're in a difficult position. We know that the interbellum years were extremely difficult years economically around the world, and especially for Jews in Eastern Europe. He says, you know what we need? We need a sefer that will take some of the beauty and the warmth and the ideas of Torah and make it accessible to the everyday person. To your average balabas, to children, to all kinds of people, limited background, not limited background. So he says, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. We need to get people inspired. We need to make it accessible to them. So I'll put something together. I'm going to put together a small work. We're going to call it Mayona Shel Torah. It's one step in a grand vision that we have to make Jewish learning more accessible to the regular, everyday man. That's the goal of this book. And so for that reason, he says, I've tried to bring like little pieces, not long essays, little pieces of Torah that everybody can share and everybody can be inspired by. That is the goal of this. And in the next page, he says, that was the introduction to the Yiddish. And now he says, in our translation, we have tried to be as faithful to the original Yiddish. Why is he talking about this? Because he dafka published it in Yiddish, not in Hebrew. Why not in Hebrew? Which is the way rabbinic... Exactly, because he wants it to be in the language of the Hamonam. He wants people to read it. And how does he publish it? This is the end of the first packet. What you have on the yellow sheet is the first two pages of the Mayona Shel Torah on this week's Parsha. And you can see, what is it? Just little fragments, little ideas. It says, everybody can read this. And you can find something to be inspired. And some of these words of Chizuk, you can see, will become almost like prophetic to the experience that he has in the ghetto. We have about 6 minutes, so we won't cover everything, but maybe we'll just do a couple of pieces. The first on the short side, Parashas Vayechi, Vayechi Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim. Yaakov merames al midas ha'emetz. Yaakov is the hint. He is the midah, the character trait of truth. Titein emes liyaakov. That's what we say in Tehillim. We say it in the davening, Shabbos Mincha. B'midas ha'emes, using with truth, efshal levalos eskol ha'itim hakashos v'hametzarim hakashim biyoser. If you hold on to the truth, you can survive even the most difficult times. And that's how he homiletically interprets the pasuk. Vayechi Yaakov, the truth lives be'eretz Mitzrayim, even in the land of Meitzar, Bein HaMitzarim, even in the difficult times, if you hang on to the truth. Where is this teaching from? Chidush Harim, the founder of the Ger Hasidic movement. A lot of these teachings come from the world of Hasidus. Why? Because that's where he was raised. That was the milieu in which he was nurtured. He came from Sachachov, this great bastion of Hasidus. Let's go to the bottom, from Rabbunim of Peshischa. Because Rashi says that Yaakov wanted to tell the children, why is it that Parshas Vayechi doesn't have a break in front of it? Because Yaakov wanted to tell the children, Bikish Lagalus Hakeis, when is the end of days? When is it going to be the end of days? Yeah. And it was closed away from him. God didn't reveal it to him. So look at the bottom. Mipnei ba Bikish Yaakov Lagalus Hakeis. Why did Yaakov want to tell them? So he says, Ki ka'asher yodim es keis hagolos. When you know the end of the exile, Ein hagolos kosha kolkach. It's not so difficult. You know it's only until there and then it's over. Baram min ha-shamayim ratzu sha-golos tiyeh kasha. But God decided that this exile would have to be difficult. Mi-beli yediyah sakeitz ulufichach nistam imenu. And that's why he wasn't told. Because God wanted it to be that much more difficult. Turn the page. Quotes from a sefer. Go about halfway down. This is just one-liner. Beautiful idea. Beautiful, beautiful. Roshei tevos shel emes. You see where I am in the third paragraph? Roshei tevos shel emes is Aron, Mita, and Tachrichim. Zeu ha-chesed hanas elameisim. Right? We talk about, in life, we talk about two kinds of chesed. You talk about chesed and chesed shel emes. So, Rashi there says, what does it mean chesed shel emes? Right? That you don't anticipate any compensation. There's nothing going to be in return. So who has a chesed shel emes? Only somebody who's going to the other world. That's why it's called a chesed shel emes. So he says in this kind of turn of phrase that the word emes is aron, mita, and tachrichim. Aron is a casket, a mita is a funeral bed, also a casket, and tachrichim are the shrouds for a person when they go to the next world, when they're buried. So he says that's the hint, that is the... That's the idea. And I want to conclude with one more vort. Let's do one more on the bottom left-hand side from a sefer called Kodesh Hilulim. I have no idea. I've never heard of the sefer Kodesh Hilulim. If it wouldn't be from Reb Zisha, I don't know if anybody would have ever heard of the sefer. We can go online. We can try to find out if maybe there's a copy of it somewhere. Maybe it's archived somewhere. Maybe it's on Hebrew books. Maybe it's in some library. But this is what you're taking from this sefer is the life of Hasidic, it's not just Hasidic learning, it's Hasidic Jewish learning in a base medrash, in not an scholarly way, in a living way. It's like living, breathing vartlach. It's like what he would have said to his friend sitting at the bus stop, you know, I have a great vart for you. You're getting into the world of Hasidus. You're finding lost books, lost Torahs. So it's not just who he was, but it's also what this book represents, considering all, everything that was destroyed. You know, he was a friend of Rav Menachem Zemba. So Rav Menachem Zemba lost, before he was murdered, Hashem Yikom Domo, he was killed on Shabbos Chol HaMoed, just Pesach, just after the uprising began. He was murdered in the street, running from one house to the other. His body was laid there all Shabbos. He was buried, then later he was reinterred and taken to Israel. Rav Menachem Zemba lost in the ghetto 10,000 pages of manuscripts. I once did a talk in one of the schools and I had them bring me a stack of textbooks. I wanted to show the students what 10,000 pages looks like. If you stack up textbooks like this, 10,000 pages from Menachem Zemba had. That was all lost, all destroyed. A whole Hebrew on the Rambam and a whole Hebrew on the Rishonim. And you think about this man Reb Zisha Friedman, he gave us, you know, who knows if any of this Torah, some of it would have, some of it wouldn't have. He published it in 1938, we have it today. And now this is, we'll end with this because it's something that's upbeat. All right, gives us something to be a little more happy about. I'm sorry we started the series with something so down. But like now, I'm never going to look at the Mayana Shel Torah the same way. Never. And I'll be like, it's unbelievable. You kiss the Sefer when you see it. So he says something amazing. From the Kodesh Yilulim, never heard of the Sefer before. Vayomer leYosef, hinei avicha chole. They told Yosef, behold, your father is sick. So the Gemara Bava Metzia, they quote here in the little lines, Ad Yaakov lo hava chulsha. Until Yaakov, there was never illness. Boy rachame vahavi chulsha. Shenemar hinei avicha chole. Look, they told Yosef, your father is sick. Wow, it's like a surprise. So the Gemara says, you know what it must be? Until Yaakov Avinu, no one ever got sick. Yaakov Avinu had to request, he davened, that there should be such a thing called a sickness. Why would he do that? So it's a very powerful, very intense concept. But the way that the Gemara seems to be describing it, and this is what the Gemara describes at length, is that one day, Avram Avinu, he just died. Yitzchak Avinu, he says, I'm getting old. Lo yadati yom mosi. He says he doesn't know when he's going to die. So he gives the bracha to the children because there's no forewarning. Rachman litzlan, sometimes that happens. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult. Rachman litzlan.
When Yaakov was by Paro, at that time, Paro thought he was looking at, because there was no aging at that time, that he was possibly looking at Avram instead of Yaakov, and that's an allusion, you know, to this aging process that started with Yaakov.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm not familiar with that image, but that makes perfect sense. So Yaakovinu comes along and says, you know what, I'm going to daven that a person should get sick. And Yaakovinu was the first of the forefathers who brought all of his children around, and he gave them brachos, and he gave them, you know, some people, that's also a matana. It's a challenging topic to talk about. Lo aleinu. It's a very, very, it's a sensitive topic. It's a challenging topic.
Why is he to be sick for that? Because like Moshe Rabbeinu, it's not like him being sick, but he knew he was going to die.
It's, I guess, Moshe Rabbeinu, so it's a good question. Moshe Rabbeinu is obviously, most people don't have their Boshalom like coming to them to tell them. So this is kind of the normal way of life. Anyway, for what was changing in Yaakov's. So the Gemara, so this beautiful little Chassidish of Art says, wait a second. It says in the Gemara that you shouldn't give somebody, you shouldn't be the bearer of bad news. So why does the Chumash say that somebody came along to Yosef and said, oh, you know your father is sick? The Gemara says, when you want to give somebody bad news, the Gemara in Pesachim, it says, let's say somebody's father passed away. So you come to tell him, and the person says, oh, how's my father? And so what should you answer? This is the Gemara says. The Gemara says, you should answer, your mother is well. And this way, you don't have to be the one to tell them that bad news. It's an interesting sensitivity. So how could it be that somebody would come to Yosef and say, oh, your father is sick? So on the last point, he says, Ella, kevad sha'ad az loha yabachla machla ba'olam. Until then, there was no sickness. Harim haya ha-shaliach omer lo sha'achem b'riyim him, ha-yosik macha masik sha'av kvar meis. If he would have said, oh, your brothers are healthy, he would have thought that Yaakov had died, because they didn't have anything called sickness. Lafisha musag machla ha-yazar lo l'chalotin. It was totally foreign to him. Lafichach, that's why he told him, your father is sick. What do I take away from this Vort Kodesh Yilulim? A very Hasidic idea, which is the way I want to end. In Hasidus, so often, it's Hasidus of Divrei Torah, and a lot of the Divrei Torah in places like Mayana Shel Torah and others, they take the bitterness that sometimes you'll find in the Torah, in life, and they'll transform it into something nice, into something positive. They'll try to find some way to give chizuk to people. So you're right, it's a bad situation. He's sick, his father's going to die. But still, we can look for something that'll make everybody feel better. You know, in this, there's a silver lining. In that, there's a silver lining. There's a little vort, a little something to bring some simcha into your world. And that, I think, is also such an integral part of this whole story, the whole story of the Mayana Shel Torah, the world of Hasidic learning, the world of the resistance of the Holocaust, is to be able to maintain that optimism, that upbeat level of energy, despite everything that was going on. So the little sparks of, like, You know, no matter, sometimes you'll find the most terrible stories in the Chumash. This is a disaster, and that's a disaster. But you know what? This little Chassidus Shavart tries to give you a little smile, to make you feel a little bit better. Try to find something, some way to turn it around. And so much of that, I wonder, and again, now this is just projecting, I wonder if that was part of his life, part of what propelled him to accomplish everything that he did, that whole outlook. And it's something that we can take into our own lives, our own outlook in terms of being positive and strengthening our Yiddishkeit and appreciating the Torah that was and that we can take with us. So that was today's Sefer V'Sofer, Mayana Shel Torah by Reb Zisha Friedman Hashem.